Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, joined today, as always, by our super producer, in between his daddy duties, Jason Ruggiero. Jason, how are you tonight?
I'm hanging in there. It's good to be back on the old podcast.
It's been a while. We've gone from about weekly to monthly now. I would say probably some of that corresponds with the changes in both of our lives. I would say that probably has a lot to do with it.
I think that's probably fair.
For those of you who aren't aware, Jason is a new father. Can we still call you a new father? Semi new father?
Sure.
A relatively new parent.
It hasn't not even spanned 1/30th of my life yet. So,
so we'll say yeah, it's you're pretty new to this game, this parenthood thing, and I am about to be married off here in a few days. So
yes, your parents have paid the dowry.
They have. It's the big Dallas Sandro Burdick merger that everyone's been waiting for.
Yes.
Now we have all this land.
I guess I would still be in my rookie year, correct?
Yeah. You're totally. Yeah. I mean, we're not even talking arbitration yet.
Oh God, no.
Yeah, you got a while to go before we get to that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of slowed us down a little bit with the podcasting.
Yes. And the starting of other businesses has not helped.
Yeah. Which I feel like that would make another great podcast topic, totally separate from baseball. So it has nothing to do with what we're going to be talking about today. So
yeah, we should just move on.
Yeah, we probably should before we get any further off topic. So Jason, today we're gonna talk about the Pirates. We're gonna talk about the Indians as usual. We'll throw in a little bit of Seawolves because I actually just got home from Joliet Park on probably what was not a great day for the Seawolves today. And then we'll wrap this jam up. But before we get started talking all that, I want to talk a little bit about the All-Star Game, which will be it'll be very quickly approaching us. July 14th will be the All-Star Game, which will be starting at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. And there's a couple interesting things to be talking about with the All-Star Game this year. First and foremost, the first thing I want to talk about is how many Kansas City Royals are going to be starting the All-Star Game. Now, full disclosure, I don't know how you feel about the All-Star Game. Actually, I do, because we've talked about it before. But so I do know how you feel about the All-Star Game. Full disclosure, for those of you who don't know how I feel about the All-Star Game, could not care less about who wins, who plays in the game. It's an exhibition. It's a day surrounded by days off on both ends that takes away from baseball in the middle of the season for me. Out of that context, I really don't care about it, other than just the fact that I just want to watch a baseball game during that period of time. So I don't really care who starts it. I don't care, you know, Jeff Locke makes the All-Star game. All right, cool. That's fine with me. I don't care if you want to run Jeff Locke out of your bullpen later in the game. Let's do it.
Go ahead. Keep making this argument.
So
you're setting me up.
So right now, as of right now, and actually I'll have to look just to confirm, but I believe right now we have 5 Kansas City Royals that are slated to start they're leading vote getters for the American League right now.
Now let's be clear. The Kansas City Royals are a good baseball team.
They are. Yeah. And they probably,
but there was,
yeah,
they deserve a couple, but there was a point when there were 9 of them, I believe.
Yeah.
The entire Kansas City Royals starting lineup was going to start the All-Star game.
That was amazing to me, by the way. Amazing. I was so excited to see that happen. I screen captured my voting. I don't care about the Kansas City Royals. I care about them in the sense that, like, I'm kind of an Indians fan, so I want them to do poorly, so that the Indians do better. But I don't really like. I follow the team because I follow baseball, and that's about the extent of it. Yeah. So like, we're talking like, you know, you got some guys, some, you know, like Salvador Perez, probably, you know, you could make an argument for him. Eric Hosmer is having a great season. Alex Gordon perennially has been great the last few years, you know, defensively and offensively. And these are
all good players.
Yeah, those are, you know, they're good players. Yeah. Their center fielder. What's their center fielder's name? Having a great season.
Lorenzo Cain.
Great season. And then you look at second base and Omar Infante.
I have some Omar Infante related things pulled up on my phone here.
Okay. Okay. Let's hear it.
Rated by WAR, Omar Infante is the number 18 second baseman in Major League Baseball. He has a wins above replacement of 0.0. If we want to talk American League, there's quite a few options here. There's Jason Kipnis, who we'll talk about later. Brian Dozier, this is in descending WAR, taking out the National League players. Dustin Pedroia, Logan Forsythe, then Dustin Pedroia, Jose Altuve. I mean, that's a good start right there. I don't think we need to name them all.
Right. any of those clearly are better players than Omar Infante.
Omar Infante has 0 home runs, 23 runs scored, 23 RBIs, and 1 stolen base, batting 237.
Is that good? I don't know if that's good.
With a WRC plus of 50.
that's so horrible.
He's walking 1.2% of the time.
That's fantastic.
1.2% of the time, folks.
That's so bad. Here's the one thing I will say about Omar Infante. We probably should refer to him as former Erie Seawolf, Omar Infante.
That's true.
So he's repping the Seawolves well.
I mean, Omar Infante, he's had his days, okay? Like, trust me, he used to play for the Tigers. I can tell you, he's had his days. But this year is not one of those days.
Yeah. So I was trying to articulate my feelings of the All-Star voting because I have a couple times voted just straight Kansas City Royals, you know, when I was filling out my ballot, which, you know, for the National League, I filled out very, you know, I fill out seriously. I kind of, you know, I'm thoughtful and earnest about it. And then for the American League, I just clicked on show me all the Kansas City Royals players and then just selected all of them.
Part of the problem.
Oh, I was definitely a part of the problem. And I'm trying to articulate how I feel about the Kansas City Royals, you know, at one point when they had all 9 of their starters starting in the All-Star game. And the best I could do was, you remember that scene in The Dark Knight where Michael Caine is talking to Christian Bale? He's talking to Batman, and they're having this really deep conversation about some kind of guy who was like terrorizing a little village and stealing all the diamonds and stuff. And then at the end he goes, "Some people just want to watch the world burn." That's kind of how I feel about this. I'm all aboard. Let's burn this mother to the ground. If we can get enough people to vote Omar Infante, and I'm all aboard. Let's do it.
Here's my beef. Okay. If the game didn't matter, like you said, it was an exhibition. If it truly was an exhibition, then I'd be on board. But the problem is the game does matter.
Right. It counts for home field advantage because Bud Selig in some, I don't know, some syphilitic insane moment in his life, like that, making the All-Star game count for home field advantage is like something that I would imagine someone would do on their deathbed as like a, you know, like a final dying wish. Just like, I need to have a legacy. Make the game count for home field advantage in the World Series. That's kind of what I imagine, like Bud Selig in like the late 1800s, dying on like a Game of Thrones set, and that's how he leaves his legacy as he's dying. It's the most insane thing ever.
Whoever came up with it is probably still working there because they're probably the ones that came up with the new home run derby format.
Yeah, which is the other kind of cool thing that we should definitely talk about piggybacking off that.
Because this home run derby business, okay, like, yeah, they need to do something, you know,
Right.
There was a lot of grandstanding and like coming out and toweling people off and things.
Right.
It was a little annoying. And then I think kind of Sammy Sosa started the tradition of, oh, I don't know, not swinging at a pitch for like 40 pitches in a row.
Right. Just waiting for that one juicy one you want.
Waiting for that one. And that business got pretty old quick. So one thing they have decided is they're going to be timed rounds.
Yeah.
Which I'm loving that. And then it's single elimination bracket style.
Yep.
Again, great. Lovely. This is all good. I think they should have stopped there.
Yeah.
Because then they decided to get cute with it. And the clock, it'll be a running clock until the last minute, I believe, where it will stop if you hit a home run, until you either don't hit a home run or swing and miss. Conspicuously absent from that list is just watching pitches go by.
Right.
So, like, you know, David Ortiz can hit a home run and then watch like 40 pitches go by and go get toweled off and get a drink and, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then you can get extra time in the last minute based on hitting the ball really far. There's like a bunch of tiers.
Yeah. So here's what the specific rules are. So the running clock begins counting down upon release of the first pitch. It stops for any home run hit during the final minute. The clock stops immediately after those home run balls land and doesn't begin again until a non-home run ball lands or the batter swings and misses. The hitters are awarded bonus time for... They receive an additional minute of swings if they hit two home runs projected to land 420 feet during a single turn, and another 30 seconds if they hit a blast of at least 475 feet.
That's stupid.
It kind of... You know what this reminded me of when I was reading it originally? It reminded me of someone trying to explain the bracket in basketball. You remember that that parody movie with Trey Parker and Matt Stone? It is like Rich Eisen and Kenny Mayne are trying to explain the bracketology of basketball. And
yeah, that's pretty accurate, I think. Yeah.
That's kind of what this is. Like, I mean, someone's gonna have to sit down and figure it out. And then listening to Chris Berman try and explain this will be, I think, that'll probably be my most favorite part of these new home run derby rules.
I don't know why they did that business at the end. The time rounds and the single elimination would have been good. Just stop there.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The All-Star game. Next thing you know, they're going to have skills competitions.
This is just the All-Star game to me is like politicians trying to justify their jobs. You know what I mean? Like, what can we do that makes it seem like we're doing something? Because if we just sit around and do nothing, people are going to catch on eventually. So let's change it to timed rounds. And then some guy's like, yeah, I got a real good idea. What if we add extra time in the last minute if they hit two home runs 420 feet or more? Yeah, it's...
You know what it sounds like to me? It sounds like they were talking about it at a bar.
Right.
And the more they drank, the better the idea sounded. Yeah. Like, when they were sober, they were like, okay, listen, these are the problems. It's boring. It drags on forever. And somebody's like, okay, fine. We'll time the rounds and single elimination. And they're like, hey, that's pretty damn good. Okay.
Jot it down on a napkin.
Let's get some beer to celebrate. That's a pretty good idea. And then, like, 2 hours later, they've got, like, and then if you hit it 420 feet, you get 30 seconds. And then...
That's probably how this came about.
And I think they typed up the press release before they sobered up, and now it's out there. There's nothing they can do.
They can't take it back, yeah. They're invested. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be better than it was, because I will tell you, even Chris Berman sounded like he got bored having to yell back, 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 back for like 3 hours, you know?
Well, he can only do that so many times. Yeah. I mean,
you would
he's
think.
Not a machine, folks.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad they're doing something, I guess, but.
The Indians are actually doing something. I'm not even sure how you say it, because it hasn't happened all year. I believe it's piling on right now. It's very strange. Going into the last inning, it was 3-1, and now it's 7-1.
Wow.
Usually they're on the other side of this. I don't know.
Yeah. Just having to take it.
Yeah. And yeah, it's all good stuff, like wild pitches and
exciting baseball stuff.
Yeah. Like, it's just nice to see someone else suffering at the hands of faithful.
So can we kind of piggyback off this and talk about the Indians a little bit?
Sure.
Because I'm ready to talk some Cleveland Indians baseball.
All right.
So what do you got for us? What are we starting off with talking about the Indians today?
Well, I think, you know, we probably start off with the guy who's just on fire and should be going to the All-Star game, Jason Kipnis.
He's a machine.
He's got something cooking right now. I think this is an interesting stat. He has 100 hits and 24 doubles already. Last year, in the entire season, he had 120 hits and 25 doubles.
Oof. Last year was rough.
I know. Last year was very rough. Okay, so you take that, right? And the last time he was in the All-Star game, I believe, was the 2013 season, where he had a really good first half and then kind of tapered off.
Yeah.
That year, he had 160 hits and 36 doubles.
And he's well on pace to
just
shatter his career highs in a lot of those.
Yeah, the only thing that's interesting is he only has 5 home runs. Whereas in those years that he was really kind of building up his reputation, he was in the mid to high teens in home runs.
Yeah, 2013 he had what, 17 maybe?
Yeah.
15,
17. He also isn't stealing as much. And he has a piddly amount of RBIs, but I believe that may be due to his team.
Yeah. And he's still stealing at a decent clip. He has, what, 10 stolen bases?
Yeah, he has 10 steals. Plus, he's also batting leadoff now, so he's not being able to drive in so many runs when Michael Bourne is batting in front of him. From the ninth position, that is.
And, you know, I tried to find, prepping for today's recording, I tried to find there was an episode prior to last season where I said, you know, Jason Kipnis is capable of putting up like MVP caliber numbers. And yeah. I mean, if you take a good hard look at Jason Kipnis's numbers there, if he were to keep this up all season long, I would be very shocked if he weren't in that discussion, because
his
numbers right now are phenomenal. And like you said, I think the only problem with his numbers is he's not getting those big counting stat numbers that you would like to see.
That's the problem. That would be the problem in the MVP voting is, you know, like, he's on pace for, like, probably 60 or 70 RBIs.
Right.
And 10 home runs. And, like, he better, you know, score a lot of home runs or keep his, like, 330 batting average if he wants any prayer of winning the MVP with 70 RBIs. Just, you know, the way people look at.
Yeah,
those stats, it's not gonna pop off the page really.
Right.
I think he's like 4.6 WAR already.
Depending on where you go.
Baseball Reference has him as 4.6.
yeah, right now he's at 4.4 on FanGraphs. So and so, that varies because for those of you who aren't aware, WAR varies between how it's calculated depending on how they calculate defensive value,
right,
primarily. So that your WAR can change based on that. But last season, for the whole season, his WAR at the end of last year was 0.8.
Yeah, 0.7 on Baseball Reference.
But
yeah,
and so what I think this shows to me is really just how much he was affected by injury last season.
Hopefully.
If you look at his, you know, career progressions, you know, 2011, he was up for a little bit. He had 150 plate appearances, hit 7 home runs. 2012 was really his first full season, 3.4 WAR at the end of the year. 2013. That was when he hit 17 home runs, you know, 86 runs, 84 RBI, 30 stolen bases. You know, and then you had last year where, you know, he only had 6 home runs at the end of the year, hit 240 at the end of the season. So I think you're seeing more of what Jason Kipnis should be than what he was last year. And I think a lot of that has to do with that oblique issue that he had. You know, he just kind of nagged with those injuries all season long.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, the thing with Kipnis is he's not one of these guys that, like, blew up out of nowhere. Almost, you could say, like a Corey Kluber.
Right.
Whose minor league track record never forecasted what he's become. Jason Kipnis in the minor leagues often went on stretches like this. Like, this is not uncommon. So it's not crazy to say that, you know, like, you're arguing that this is, in fact, Jason Kipnis. This isn't a fluke, you know?
Right.
It's not like he's never done this before. He's done it before for half a season in the majors, and he's done it in the minors multiple times. It's certainly nice, especially after last year, and especially with the kind of albatrosses of Swisher and Bourne, that Kipnis's contract this year suddenly looks like a bargain instead of added to the list of, oh God.
Right, yeah.
Oh, I think Fangraphs had a thing. It was the biggest bargains of 2015, and Kipnis was at the top, if not, I don't think he was the top. I think Bryce Harper was the top. But he was right up there.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find it while you're talking about something.
Well, I mean, when you look at Kipnis and his progression, you know, he came out of college, so you kind of expected him to progress a little bit quicker, but, you know, he started in low A, you know, progressed to high A, double A, triple A, and was in the majors, you know, right away. Made those natural progressions. Has a pretty steady career K to walk rate, you know, nothing crazy, really fluctuating. And then you look at last season and you can kind of see the aberration that it was. I firmly believe that Jason Kipnis is closer to a 300 hitter, 400 OBP guy, you know, than he is to a 240 hitter with a 300 OBP, you know?
Yeah. Well, he certainly, you know, to your point, he certainly has he's shown throughout his career the plate discipline, like you're saying, that, you know, makes that a believable believable belief.
Right, yeah.
A believable assertion. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like we're saying that some guy was like, you know, 40% K rate and a 5% walk rate. Oh, yeah, he could hit 300. It's like,
right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This is a guy who, you know, has shown a lot of plate discipline over his career. And
he got better this season. You know, is so far through the year, you know, his career strikeout rate is 18%. This season, he's striking out 13.5%.
Yeah.
And you can go look at... you know, go look at his card on Brooks Baseball, and you can kind of see the heat maps and the areas where he's, you know, actually improving. I like Jason Kipnis. I really think, you know, when I said it at the beginning of last season, I meant it, and I still believe it. I think he could be an MVP candidate, you know, if he stays healthy a whole season and keeps putting those numbers up.
Yeah. No, he certainly can. I think, like we said, the only thing that could hurt him is his counting stats, and some of that is the Indians' failure to drive in runs, which they've all suffered from. It's not even necessarily him, because, like I said, he's batting at the top of the lineup. He's not even getting the opportunities the other guys are getting.
Right, yeah. And he's doing them a lot of favors. I mean, he's getting on base, you know, .418 on base percentage this season.
Yeah. Yeah. Jason Kipnis is not the root of the problem.
So, yeah, that leads, that begs the question, what is going on with the Indians this season? Because I think, and I'd have to go back and look at my preseason predictions, I think I predicted a Pittsburgh-Cleveland World Series.
Yeah, you weren't the only one.
And right now...
Eric Carabel did, I know, and he wasn't the only one either.
Yeah. Right now, the Indians are 8 games under .500, 12 games back of the Royals.
Yeah. They've consistently struggled to even approach .500, let alone break it.
Right, and they're playing pretty horribly at home. You know, they're .500 on the road, but they're 15-23 at home. So
yeah, they're disgusting at home.
What's going on with the Tribe? What is the root of their problems this season?
Well, I mean, this isn't a very analytical answer to start with, but we'll start here, and that's just that it has literally been if it's not one thing, it's another. You know, the starting pitching was much ballyhooed going into the year, and at times it has been quite spectacular and lived up to expectations, and at other times it has been quite dismal. That certainly hasn't been helped by the injuries that they've suffered. You know, and some of that is depth, but depth certainly is critical to starting pitching. When you lose Gavin Floyd and Josh Tomlin, and Bruce Chen proves he has outlived his usefulness, perhaps, and Sean Markham, you know, wears out his welcome, and I mean, you start burning through that many of your backup options. You know, things can turn ugly, and that's, you know, how you saw Toru Muratu make his major league debut yesterday. You know, that the second game of a doubleheader is not often when you see a team's best prospect or person come out, but when you get to guys like that because you've already exhausted all the other options, it's not really a good sign. Thankfully, Cody Anderson has pitched incredibly well in his two starts. I mean, the fifth spot in the rotation has been a revolving door, but that's not so much a problem in itself. I think, you know, there's a lot of teams that have that kind of scenario. The problems, you know, like Trevor Bauer has been great on the road and awful at home. Corey Kluber overall has been well, but or pitched well, but he's also had some kind of clunkers where he goes out and, you know, pitches 5 or 6 innings and gives up 4 runs.
Right.
And that's not really what you were expecting. Danny Salazar, you know, has his Danny Salazar moments where he strikes out 12 people one game, and then I think it was against the Tigers a few weeks ago, they desperately needed a good game from Danny Salazar, and he was just cruising through 5 innings, and then there was like a botched bunt attempt where he should have been able to throw the runner out at home, and before you know it, he hadn't given up a run in the first 4 innings, and then he didn't make it through the 5th inning. And it's just like, that seems to be, you know, happening a lot. There's a lot of the snowball effect. And it's like when the starting pitching suffers, you know, the game tends to be like 7-6. And when the starting pitching is on, they can't score a run. Or when the starting pitching leaves and the offense has done just enough and it's 3-1, the bullpen implodes and gives up 6 runs. It just there's not much consistency and rhythm. I think some of it is there's certainly some players that are underperforming. Some of those players have been jettisoned, like you saw the release of Scott Acheson in exchange for, you know, Austin Adams, who can throw 100 miles an hour. You know, we've seen Lonnie Chisenhall be demoted in exchange for Giovanni Urshela, who, you know, in a limited sample is batting .275 and playing, you know, much better defense. I mean, his defensive war on Fangraphs is -0.6, but Lonnie Chisenhall. Well, see, Lonnie Chisenhall, this is the interesting thing. His defensive WAR was 4. So, you know, sometimes those things are still a work in progress. I mean, the eye test certainly leans heavily in favor of Urshela. But, you know, even if that is the case, Chisenhall was batting 209 with a WRC plus of 60. And again, in limited plate appearances, only like 50, so Urshela's WRC plus is 91. You know, we've seen Jose Ramirez get demoted in exchange for Francisco Lindor.
Which saddens my heart, by the way.
Yeah. It had to happen, though. It was so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, they were literally, I don't think, you know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, making a trade. I would be shocked if you see Jose Ramirez involved in a trade right now, because he has more value to the Indians than to someone else, because right. The Indians, I think, have more faith in him than anyone else right now. You know, we've seen Michael Bourne be demoted to a part-time number 9 hitter. We've seen Yan Gomes deal with one serious injury and then one kind of nagging neck injury. So, I mean, those are kind of the overall problems. I mean, Jose Ramirez, just to touch on that, his offensive value in his brief time is like 46 games was negative 10.3, and his defensive value was negative 2, which is not at all what anyone expected from Jose Ramirez. I think they expected like a positive defensive value and maybe a roughly even offensive value.
Right, yeah.
So that they could only put up with that for so long. And Francisco Lindor has looked great defensively. I mean, he's made his share of, you know, rookie mistakes, certainly, but he's looked much better than Jose Ramirez, and he is hitting, I think, better than a lot of people expected. Of course, it's small sample size, but you can just see his swing at times, and it kind of catches your eye. You're like, oh, really?
It is a smooth swing.
That was very nice. I mean, his first hit, you know, he fell down rounding first. That was kind of embarrassing, but the swing he put on that ball was pretty impressive. So I mean, that's kind of where we're at. I mean, like I said, when you get to guys like you're running out, you know, Jeff Manship and well, Ryan Rayburn and David Murphy for some pitching innings, that's never good. But I mean, like, you know, when you're digging up Ryan Webb off the waiver wire, which Ryan Webb I think was actually a really good signing because he had like really good peripherals and they kind of scooped him up. But when you're digging off the waiver wire for what become important pieces of your bullpen midseason, that is never a good time. Like, of the bullpen, like, you know, guys that we counted on, Zebchinski, 0.2 WAR, Hagedorn, 0.1, Crockett, 0, CC Lee, 0, Ryan Webb, negative 1, Brian Shaw, negative 1. That's not good. I mean, yeah. Bullpen guys are never going to rack up a ton of WAR. I mean, Cody Allen, and he's got 1.1, and Zach Callister has 0.7, but when most of your bullpen is right around 0.
That's not good.
not a good sign.
And Cleveland pitchers have been putting a ton of runners on base.
Absurd.
Like the Indians team whip right now is 1.3. Like that's a lot of runners on base. A lot of runners.
Yeah. It's just not a good way to make a living, that's for sure. And the bullpen has stabilized a little bit, but it's one of the, you know.
Yeah, like McAllister's been great since he, you know, made that shift to the bullpen. He's striking out almost 11 batters per 9.
Yeah, let me see. I have that right here somewhere. McAllister, yeah, 10.98 K per 9. You know, Cody Allen, 14 K per 9, but he's also got a 4.22 walk per 9. you know, it's like, that's not horrible, but you're making your life a lot more difficult than it needs to be.
Right, that's not what you want out of your late-inning guys. Your late-inning guys, you know, you're looking at guys that have like a 1-1 whip
right.
in this day and age of baseball. They're not putting a lot of guys on base.
The only way Cody Allen is surviving how he is because he's striking out 14 people per nine.
Right.
You know, if, like, you know, everybody's about ready to boot Nick Hagedone overboard, and he's like at 9 K per nine and 4 walk per nine, and everybody's, you know, complaining about him and wanting to, you know, swap Kyle Crockett. Well, Kyle Crockett's even worse. So kind of in this mode right now where what you have may not be working, but you don't really have, for a whole bunch of reasons, but you don't really have any other options per se. Like, yes, there's guys like CC Lee and Austin Adams who have had very little exposure. I think between the two of them, you know, they've only pitched like 14 innings or something this year. But again, it's like with the starting pitching, you have to be careful how quickly you go to that well.
Right.
Because, you know, if you make those changes, obviously you don't want to make them too late, but if you make them too soon and then CC Lee struggles, what now? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's guys like Sean Armstrong, Sean Morimondo, you know, there's people, but
so what's the deeper
you have to dig.
What's the long-term prognosis for Cleveland? Are things going to be getting better for the Tribe as the season progresses, or do you kind of think that what we're seeing is what's going to be the 2015 Cleveland Indians?
Well, I think they're in the middle of pulling that awful stunt again where they're making Chris Antonetti's job really difficult, where he has a good base, but it's kind of like, you guys are not really giving me much reason to go down and trade, you know, Eric Gonzalez or Tyler Naquin or someone for something. Because so what if I trade Eric Gonzalez and Tyler Naquin for, it would take more than this, but, you know, Adrian Beltre. Adrian Beltre is not enough.
Right.
I'm really curious what they're going to do. I think if I know Chris Antonetti, he's not going to make any rash moves, and he's going to ride this out until the last possible moment. And then he may, like, you know, find some way to hedge his bet at the trade deadline. Like, he will not trade. If they don't get up to 500 by the trade deadline, you know, they're not going to trade for Adrian Beltre, but he will certainly, I would imagine, look at, you know, what if I take Urshela and Gonzalez and Naquin? Can I go get a third baseman that I can keep for 2, 3, 4 years? How much does that cost? You know, that's what I think he's going to be looking at even more so than the rental. I mean, we know that the Pirates and the Indians shy away from the rentals, but if they can't even, you know, bridge 500, the rentals are pretty much off the table. And if they can't get there, there's people on this current team that they'll probably explore. I don't know if they would explore a Carlos Santana trade, but it certainly becomes more of an option the less competitive they are. I mean, Santana has like an amazing, you know, like runs created stat.
Right.
But he is really frustrating everyone, I think, with his ability to actually put the ball in play.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I don't know. I mean, they're very sabermetrically aligned, obviously, but I don't know how tolerant they are of his 220 batting average with his 400 on base percentage.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what they could get for him. I think in the right environment, you know, with the right package, the right team on the other side, they could get a fair amount. They certainly don't really have a ready replacement for him, so that's makes things a little more complicated. Unless they want to go with, you know, Jesus Aguilar, they certainly can't count on Nick Swisher.
Yeah, they're in a very interesting position.
They definitely
haven't made themselves buyers.
No. They can't really unload Michael Bourne on anyone. I mean, there's a lot of talk that, you know, the Dolans should just eat that money and they should release him. Like, I can't see that ever happening. They're just going to really manage his at-bats so they can ensure that, you know, I guess his player options the year after next. So they don't even have to do that right now, but I guess that's what they're kind of doing by setting him up with that platoon right now. They're basically putting that in his head that you're going to be a platoon player next year too, and you're never going to get your option to vest.
Right.
Nick Swisher, I have no idea. And then, you know, they're locked in. I mean, they're not going to move away from Brantley. They're not going to move away from Moss, I wouldn't think. He fits their mold. He is power. He is cost controlled. I don't know why they would trade him. Obviously, they're not moving away from Lindor. They're embracing the future with Lindor. They're not moving away from Kipnis, and they're not going away from Gomes. So you don't have too many places as far as position players that you have any moves. You know, and they have Santana under control, and Urshela's cheap. It's just whether you want to stick with Urshela or find something different. And frankly, I think Naquin is making a case to replace Michael Bourne in center field, not be traded to find his replacement. Let me pull up Tyler Naquin's stats here.
And Bourne would be other than the amount of money that you're paying him, but I mean, just in theory, would be a fine guy to come off the bench. You know what I mean? He would be a solid late inning guy that you could put in if you need someone to play defense or, you know, someone to run and then, you know, stick around in the game.
He would, except for the fact that he's left-handed like all the rest
of
them.
Well, yeah, and that would be the only downside, but you don't have any. You don't, like, right-handers in Cleveland are rare.
Yeah, they have Tyler Holt. I mean, that's pretty much, which, see, that's the argument is, you know, wouldn't Tyler Holt be just as effective as Michael Bourne? And it's might be the case. I don't know. Naquin was recently promoted, so he's only got like 18 games in AAA, but in AA, he was hitting .348, an OPS of .887. And he had, let's see, 12 doubles. He only had one homer, but, you know, he's hitting .348. So he's stealing 7 bases. Let's see, 15 walks to 24 strikeouts. So it's not, you know, pretty decent numbers. Now he is a little advanced, perhaps, for Akron. So we'll see what he does in Columbus, but he's had a very good year, which, you know, you have to think too. Yeah, he's a little old for Akron, but he was just getting the swing of it last year. He was hitting .313 and really coming into his own, and he broke his hand. So that was, you know, he probably should have started. If he hadn't broken his hand, he would have started the year in Columbus this year, but they had to return him there because he just hadn't had that many at bats there.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, like I said, the pitching is pretty much tapped out. Like, Cody Anderson is the extent of their pitching depth in the minors, starting pitching wise anyways. So hopefully they don't need any more starters. And they do have some bullpen options, although the bullpen has started to solidify a little. And position player wise, other than Aguilar and Naquin, you know, there's not much else that's like immediately ready. They already hit on Lindor. They already hit on Urshela. Holt is available, but it's, I guess, debatable how much of an upgrade he would be. So
that's it with Cleveland, huh?
That's what's going on in Cleveland. What's going on in Pittsburgh? They rattled off quite a little win streak about a week and a half ago.
Yeah, sure did. Pittsburgh, just like basically every season since we've started this podcast, started off the season the exact same way they've started off the last couple seasons, which is digging their hole so deep that effectively they spend the rest of the season trying to play catch up with the Cardinals, which, you know, again, this season they're doing the same thing. As of right now, they're 9 games back of the Cardinals after the Cardinals' late night victory last night on Sunday Night Baseball. So the Pirates are currently 42-33, which is a great mark to be at, unless you're in the National League Central, and the Cardinals are 51-24. 51-24. Like, it's almost unfair.
No, I know.
That the Pirates have finally gotten good, and the Cardinals are just like, meh, we'll get better. That's kind of what it feels like. I think the Cardinals hacking has really... They figured something out, Jason, in the Matrix. That they're like, we can lose Adam Wainwright and, you know, Matt Adams and, you know, Lance Lynn, and we can lose all these guys, and we'll just put somebody else in there, and it'll be all right. And that's just what they've done.
Absurd. It's a little absurd how much they have lost.
And
not
yet,
even just this year, but I mean, like, from previous teams, like you know. Like last year's team, you're like, well, that team was pretty good. And you're like, but. And they're like, no, we'll just take this guy we found here and we'll just plug him in. And actually, you know what? He's better than that.
Yeah, and it works out. They're like, okay, Albert Pujols, you want that much money? We'll just move on without you. See ya, yeah, MVP.
You can just leave.
Greatest St. Louis Cardinals since Stan Musial? Yeah, all right. We'll see you later. We're going to plug in Matt Adams. And the corpse of Mark Reynolds. And somehow it just works. It's very frustrating.
Well, you don't have to tell me. I mean, like, you know, Mark Reynolds was on the Indian. He didn't do nothing.
Well, he hit that. You remember that one? He had that hit by pitch and then hit that monster, like, 500 foot home run.
He had, like, what was it?
And then after that,
he had that. And then he had, like, that 2-week stretch, you know, where he just, like, hit home run after home run. And see, that's the thing, like, you watch the Cardinals, and I feel the same way about the Royals at times. And you're just so skeptical of them. Like, you're just like, yeah, well, just wait. That guy's not very good.
But however they do it, they just figure out how to extract the value. And Pittsburgh does it, you know, to a degree, with players like AJ Burnett. You know, they've gotten a lot of, and Francisco Liriano, particularly with the pitchers, you know, I call it the race series witchcraft that they have. But
you know who else does it is the Giants. Like, they're like, oh, we're just gonna take, let's see, we'll just get like Joe Panic and Mike Duffy and Nori Aoki
and Ryan Vogelsong. Yeah.
Angel Pagan's going to hit cleanup, and that's going to be okay.
Yeah, and it works. It just works. I don't know how it works, but it does.
And you're like, what the heck? Like, if the Indians signed Angel Pagan, he'd, like, hit 230.
Yeah, right, yeah.
It just would never work.
Right, yeah. And, yeah, I mean, everything just... They spin the gold in St. Louis. I don't know how they do it. So, the Pirates, they currently sit 9 games back of the Cardinals. Very, very frustrating. And, you know, quite honestly, the Cubs are pretty hot on the Pirates' heels right now. The Cubs are 39-35. So they're about...
Cubs are just not giving up.
No, they are far from that. And I think we talked about the Cubs a podcast at the beginning of this season. Maybe it was late last season. You know, I thought the Cubs were going to be good probably starting like next season, when you'd see guys like, you know, Chris Bryan and Jorge Soler... Addison, you know, once they traded for Addison Russell, they had Addison Russell. You know, like, I figured next season things would start looking a lot better for the Cubs. And really, it's everybody that the Cubs have been calling up, they've been performing really, really well coming out of the gate. So, you know, the Cubs are kind of scared. You know, right now for the wild card, you have the Pirates and the Giants. And then you have the Cubs that are 1.5 games back. That's pretty scary. You have the Mets behind the Cubs. You have the Diamondbacks behind the Mets. You know, it gets progressively less scary pretty quickly. So, but I mean, the wild card's looking pretty tight right now with, you know, the Pirates, the Giants, the Cubs.
Yeah, it's got to be frustrating, you know, like you said, every time the Pirates get better, the Cardinals just get even better.
Yeah.
I mean, you're almost 9 games, you're 9 games over 500, but you're 9 games out of first place.
Right. I mean, if you put the Pirates in just about any other division, they would be, you know, leading the division or within like a couple games.
Well, let's see. They'd have the NL East because they have the same wins and less losses. They would be one game out in the NL West. And why? What's my? There we go. They'd be first in the AL East, second in the AL Central. I think it'd be 2 games behind the Royals and 2 games behind the Astros in the West.
So it's, yeah. I mean, in the Central, they're 9 games back at the Cardinals.
Yeah.
It's tough. It gets kind of aggravating. And they actually had a great graphic on one of the Pirates broadcasts a few weeks ago. It was the Pirates calendar for the month of, it was May into June, but it was for like a month, the Pirates calendar for a month. And then underneath it, you know, they had the Pirates win-loss result each day. And then underneath that, they had the St. Louis Cardinals win-loss result each day. And it was like the Pirates win, the Cardinals win. The Pirates lose, you know, the Cardinals win. And it was like just back and forth, you know, so like then the Pirates would win and then the Cardinals would win. The Pirates would lose. The Cardinals would win. And it would just like for like a month, you know, you had no progress with the Pirates gaining any ground. And this was like right after, you know, you had Matt Adams going down. I think it was Lance Lynn who had that forearm strain or something with his arm. So, you know, he was out of the rotation for a while. And just the Cardinals didn't even miss a beat. They just kept right on winning. It is very aggravating knowing that, like, we're probably already having to play for the wild card.
Yeah, but, I mean, when you look at the wild card, I mean, the Mets are tanking, so I wouldn't worry about them too much. But, yeah, I mean, I could see the Cubs hanging around. And, like we said, the Giants will always hang around. They'll hold it together with, you know.
And the thing about the Mets is I don't think the Mets really have the offense. You know, the Mets pitching, you look at that rotation, and particularly with some of the players that they've, you know, been calling up, you know, they have Syndergaard and, you know, Mats is throwing the other day. Like, their rotation looks really, really good. And that's without Zach Wheeler in the middle of their rotation. But.
Yeah, they have a nice rotation. That's the only thing really they got, though.
So, When you're looking at the Pirates and why they've been performing so well, I think one of the key players that you can look at has been Starling Marte, who's really been carrying this roster. You know, for most of the season. McCutchen started out the season really slow, and there were a lot of questions about his knee. And, you know, he continued to say that his knee was fine and that everything would be okay, and it didn't really, you know, stuff just did not look right at the beginning of the season. And then it was about after the first month or so of not hitting, he's really turned it on, you know, for the last, I don't know, 200 at bats or so.
Yeah, I had McCutchen in fantasy, in my fantasy league, and I paid quite a pretty penny for him. And I was a little nervous, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, and he hasn't been running a lot. You know, the stolen bases are down. I think he has four stolen bases on the season.
Yeah.
Right now, but everything else is kind of getting back to what you would expect. He's not striking out a ton. He's hitting for average. You know, he's back to hitting for power. You know, the home runs necessarily aren't overwhelming, but, you know, he has 9 home runs. You know, he's walking again at a pretty decent clip. He's getting on base, you know, a .383 on base percentage. So he's getting back to that level of performance that you really expected. I think the problem at the beginning of the season with the Pirates, and again, one of the things that has really, when you talk about the Pirates kind of digging their own grave at the beginning of the season, Josh Harrison started off the year and was about as cold as you could imagine over the first month, coupled with Andrew McCutchen, who started off the season not performing. And you basically had Starling Marte, who was doing a lot of the heavy lifting with that lineup. you know, Neil Walker's power really hasn't returned from last season. His slugging is back down to 378. He only has 4 home runs on the year. So you're having to kind of rely on just, you know, whatever offense Starling Marte can give us on a nightly basis is really what we're going to have to be going with. Pedro Alvarez is doing kind of his Pedro Alvarez thing. I think it's even more pronounced now that he's been moved to first base. Like, he's going to hit his share of home runs. He has 10 home runs on the season. He's going to walk at a decent rate. He has 24 walks on the year, which, you know, he's not getting on base kind of at the level that you would expect for Pedro Alvarez, but, you know, he's still walking a little bit. But defensively at first base, that shift from third to first, those errors that he makes at first are just so much more pronounced because they're errors that you don't expect to see a first baseman making errors on, like a line drive hit on him right at a rope that just bounces out of his mitt. It's really, really weird to see the types of errors that Pedro makes at first base. You know, every time that there's a pickoff throw over, it kind of like you kind of flinch a little bit because you're not sure what is going to happen with that ball. Like I said, the other day, someone hit a drive and it literally just hit him square in the mitt, bounced right out of his mitt. it gets tough to watch his defense at first base. And you know, his defense at third base last year was pretty rough, but it's been equally rough, if not more so, this season at first. To my point, his walk rate is down a little bit from last year, about 0.3 of a point. So he's walking 9.8% of the time, relative to his 10.1 last year. He's striking out a little bit less, I guess, to kind of balance that. The isolated slugging is 192, so it's a pretty decent power. But I don't think Pedro Alvarez is ever going to go back to that, like, 36 home run, you know, power threat that he was in 2013.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. You know, what's the prognosis, do you think, for Pedro's future? You kind of already answered that. I mean, you don't think he's going to ever become that power threat again. What do you think his future with the Pirates is?
I think it's we have one more year with Pedro, so we should have arbitration again this year. But he was that Super 2 eligible player, so he went to arbitration a year early. So I believe next year will be his last year under contract with the Pirates. I think they're going to just ride out whatever production they can get from him. I don't see them trading because I think they'll still be, you know, competitive next season. And if you're a contender, you're not selling off parts like Pedro Alvarez. You know, even if you're going to lose him at the end of the year. And I think basically he's just a placeholder for Josh Bell. That's really kind of what I firmly believe. Josh Bell made that transition to first base. You know, he's handled every level fairly well. Once he got past that initial, I think he had some knee issues to kind of start off his career, but you know, since then he's just kind of been doing his thing at each level and hitting the ball well. And so I think he's just kind of a placeholder for that. As long as Josh Bell keeps progressing like he should, I don't see why, you know, we're not going to be seeing Josh Bell in a Pirates uniform. This season, Bell's in AA Altoona, which is where he finished the year last year. He's hitting .325 with a .395 on base percentage, a .444 slugging. You know, 3 home runs. He's striking out nearly as much as he walks, about 10%. So that's kind of what I think about Pedro Alvarez. I think he's just kind of there. I think you'll see Josh Bell in AAA maybe at the end of this season, but, you know, if not, definitely next season. And then depending on how things go next season, you might see, you know, Bell at the end of the season taking some of those reps at first, and Alvarez is gone.
Yeah, I can certainly see that.
That's how I see things ending. For
him. Pedro Alvarez era.
Yeah, and I'll be okay once it's over. Not that Josh Bell could be, you know, Josh Bell could come up and not be anything, but I just, you can see what Pedro Alvarez is, and it's not,
yeah, nothing to be too concerned about losing.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, whatever he's giving you offensively, defensively.
Yeah. It's going out the window.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just a couple other points that I wanted to bring up. Jung Ho Gong has been taking quite a few plate appearances away from Jordy Mercer. And I don't know that it's necessarily he's taking them away. He's kind of being plugged in around the infield in a lot of different places. Mercer has 217 at-bats to Gong's 181 this season. But you're seeing Gong more frequently in the lineup than you were, than I guess I was expecting at the beginning of the season.
Gong has, not necessarily a bad thing.
Right, yeah, it's not a bad thing. Mercer was good last season. He certainly wasn't all-star great that you would imagine he couldn't be replaced, but Gong is slugging .381 this season. He has 4 home runs. He's kind of doing what you would expect, you know, what he was expected to do coming over, which was hit for a, you know, decent amount of power. He strikes out roughly 22% of the time, or he has so far this season in his 204 plate appearances. He's walked 7.4% of the time. He's been okay offensively. He's been pretty solid. Defensively, he's been not horrible. He hasn't been phenomenal, but he hasn't been so bad that you can't imagine him, you know, playing defensively, I guess. So, right. I mean, I feel like this could have been Mercer's chance to come right out of the gate and say, this is my job. I'm going to, you know, grab the bull by the horns and take it. But he hasn't really done that in any aspect of his game this season, offensively or defensively. So it's kind of been like plugging in Gong when it seems to make sense to do that. He's been playing a little bit of third, a little bit of short. So he's been an interesting player to watch. I know I mentioned at the beginning of the season, his swing in the spring looked rough, and he had alternating leg kicks. He has a super high leg kick usually, and then there was a period of time where he was adjusting with 2 strikes and not having his gigantic leg kick, and then that kind of changed, and now it seems like he's using his high leg kick even with 2 strikes. So it's been kind of hard to watch his at-bats and see, you know, without really being able to talk to him and ask him, well, why are you leg-kicking sometimes and not other times? You know, you don't really get a feel for what he's doing other than just what you're seeing. And I haven't been able to find anything that shows anyone asking him any questions about it. No one's really been writing about it. So it's just kind of, you know, you have to look at it and watch and see what's happening and kind of infer on your own what's going on with this swing. The other point that I wanted to talk about was Gregory Polanco's progression, or I guess you could say lack thereof so far this season. His numbers look a little bit better because he's padding them with some stolen bases. But if you look past just the stolen bases, offensively he hasn't progressed since last season. He's basically been worth the same offensive value that he was last season, which was not so great.
Yeah.
But not horrible for a 20, you know, what was he last season? 22-year-old kid. You know, now at 23 with some at-bats.
You were hoping for some progression.
Right, you were hoping with some progression. I said at the beginning of the season, basically you needed Gregory Polanco to be a league average offensive player, which he hasn't even been that this season. And like I said, the stolen right. bases make his numbers a little more palatable, especially if you think about traditional numbers that like fantasy players want to look at.
Right.
But his, let me pull it up, make sure I have this correct. I said, so like a league average player would be an OPS plus of, excuse me, an OPS plus of 100 is what you would be looking for. Adjusted to league average, 100 would be a league average player. Last season, Polanco was 84, and that's about where he's at this season as well.
Right.
So you haven't really seen those offensive strides. He's striking out a little bit more. His power has stayed the same, and he's doing all of this with a reasonable BABIP. His BABIP's 289, so it's not like you're expecting like some big shift in his numbers to suddenly happen. So Polanco's not really making the progress that you would hope that he would make. I don't know if there's a period of time where you talk about sending him back down to AAA to kind of iron out some of those problems down there. But the move that the Pirates made that kind of surprised me, where I thought that that might make sense, demoting Polanco, the Pirates DFA'd Jose Tabata so that they could call up Workies Hernandez, which to me just screams clubhouse issues. Tabata's been in Hurdle's doghouse before. And it's not like he was performing awfully. He wasn't performing so bad that you're shocked that Jose Tabata's putting up those numbers. So I don't really know what's going on. The progress with Polanco has not been where I had hoped that it would be coming into his first full season. So that's just something else to keep an eye on as well.
Yeah, I guess, it's surprising to see them call up Gorky's Hernandez, for sure. And like you said, Tabata was not lighting the world on fire, but he wasn't doing anything that egregious, just to be DFA'd. He's making $4.5 or $4 million or something.
Yeah.
So, we know how the Pirates and the Indians operate. Like, they'll DFA people when there's other issues that make it the most prudent thing to do, but they're not kind of clubs that just eat $4 million like it's nothing.
Right. And they're stuck with that. There's no way Jose Tabata is giving up that.
Well, right, because I think he can refuse his assignment, but then he'll forfeit that money,
that'll never happen. Yeah.
This is basically the Pirates' way of bullying him back into AAA.
Right.
And then he'll be forced to sit down there, and if there is an issue, he'll probably continue to have an attitude issue.
Right.
Because of everything that's transpired here.
I will be curious to see whether there is any reporting about why. I haven't seen anything yet other than just Robert Temple stating that he was DFA'd, but no explanation as to why, just that he was DFA'd. So, he wasn't hitting for power, but, he was hitting 282. He was
going to say he was hitting like 280 something. His slugging was like almost 280 something, but, he at least was hitting.
Right. So, yeah.
Getting, the bat on the ball at least a little bit.
So Polanco's progress could really go a long way to help the Pirates.
That's the more important storyline here. What is the future of Gregory Polanco? And if he needs to be sent down, what the prognosis of Gorky's Hernandez or his replacement is.
Yeah, I can tell you Gorky's Hernandez probably doesn't offer you much more production than what Gregory Polanco is offering you.
Yeah.
I feel fairly confident in that.
I agree.
But I don't know. The fact that Polanco hasn't progressed is not a good sign. The fact that he's stagnated or in the eyes of some statistical categories, probably gotten worse, is bad for his future.
Right, so, and there's... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's worth watching to see how Pittsburgh handles that.
Yeah, because there's two storylines. One is the development and future development of Gregory Polanco and what's best for that. And the other is trying to catch the Cardinals.
Yeah.
And the two may not line up very well.
Yeah. So that'll be a storyline worth watching.
Yeah.
So that's it for the Pirates. Before we wrap up today, really quickly, I just want to mention the Seawolves. I just got back from Geriot Park earlier tonight. The Seawolves were finishing up a doubleheader, in which I believe they dropped both games, but I'll have to double check. They definitely, they lost the first game, and it looks like
they were on their way to losing the other games.
They lost the second game as well. Yeah, so they dropped both games of the doubleheader today. So going into today, I don't think these are actually updated, but the Seawolves were last. They're going to remain last after these two losses, believe it or not. So they were 29-46 going into today. So I don't believe that's been updated. Not a great year for watching winning baseball in Erie.
It's the preferred kind, but
Although you would expect, I guess, some regression when you're seeing like the best players progress through the system. Like Steven Moya last year was destroying baseballs, and now he's no longer around. He's up in Toledo, and he was on the DL for a while in Toledo, I think. But so a lot of their players, Eugenio Suarez, these are guys that are like up in the major leagues. Hernan Perez is playing up in the major leagues. James McCann just had another walk-off the other day. So a lot of their talent has progressed through the system, is no longer in Erie. And they have some guys back, Wade Gaynor, Dean Green has hit a couple monster shots this year, but they're not guys that are going to carry a team like a Steven Moya necessarily. So the baseball hasn't been great, but the Buck Knights have been a lot of fun. Again, I think one of the best deals in all of minor league baseball. If you're looking to go out to a stadium for a reasonable price, dollar hot dogs, dollar draft beers, dollar popcorn, so like all kinds of stuff for a dollar on Buck Night, it's a pretty good time. So a lot of it just depends on what you're looking for, but yeah, the Seawolves, not a great season of baseball to be watching thus far, although they did rattle off a pretty impressive streak. I think it was they'd won maybe 8 out of their last 11 at one point over the last 11 games, I think, leading up to yesterday or the day before. So they had some pretty good baseball going on for a little bit, but not enough to dig them out of the basement of the Eastern League West. So that's where we're at with the Seawolves.
Better days are coming.
Yeah.
Eventually, maybe.
Eventually, yeah.
We've said that the Tigers system is bad, and this is kind of...
Yeah, you're seeing that now.
It's coming home to roost, because we kept saying that, and it's like, oh, well, Steven Moya and James McCann and Eugenio Suarez, well, that was kind of it.
Right. And when those guys all leave, you're left a pretty big void that you have to fill there.
Yeah.
So, still, make sure you show up to the Yut, though. Again, minor league baseball, a lot of it is about the fan experience and not just the baseball. So if you go
exactly
some of the other things to do, Geriot Park is one of the more fan-friendly parks that I've been to in minor league baseball. So stop by, say hi to our friend of the podcast, Greg Coleman. Tell him Tri-State of Mind Baseball sent you. So I think that's going to wrap us up for today, Jason. Do we have anything else we want to touch on?
No, I think that's it.
That's it. So we'd like to, again, thank our listeners and ask if you're listening to us on iTunes that you give us a rate and review. Our podcasting will be sporadic, but we will be doing it throughout the course of the season. Maybe not every week, maybe every month, every couple weeks, but keep your ear to the ground and we'll definitely be talking some baseball. In the meantime, you can check us out on the web at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter at tristatebb, and you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/TSM Baseball. So for Jason Ruggiero, this is Andy Burdick, and we look forward to talking to you soon.